This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, making shit happen. The most common writing fail.
Hey Jules. Remember way back when we started Dissecting Dragons and we didn't use swear words?
I dimly remember those days.
Yeah, we censored ourselves, if I recall. We were very diplomatic. And then I think everything changed when we had an episode on swear words.
Yeah.
And then we just became laxer and laxer, and now here we are. Here we are. She's gone straight for it. It's right in the title.
Yeah. To be
new
fair.
Age.
To be fair, I think it says things in a way that you couldn't with making stuff happen or making things happen. I'm going to give credit here to Julie Cohen, who is a very successful writer and a lovely person. And if you ever have the opportunity to attend one of her writing workshops, I recommend you grab the opportunity with both hands. And this was originally her title, and I've kind of nicked it. and it was a particularly good workshop. In fact, I've never been to a workshop by her that wasn't worth going for. So go, pay whatever she asks. Your writing will be much better because of it. There you go.
Okay, so let's talk about making shit happen.
Yeah.
This is within the context of a story. I mean, it's a good idea in life in general.
Yeah, don't just let life happen to you.
Don't just let life. But why don't you start by defining what you mean by making shit happen?
I won't say it's a recent trend, but there are novels out there where there is beautiful characterization, there's a great concept, there's 20 years plus of exquisite backstory, and the actual novel proper, nothing happens. Nothing happens at all. And I don't mean a story where it's very character driven and a lot of the journey is internal. I mean, literally nothing happens. And it's kind of becoming a bugbear. And it does feed into my new obsession with structure, which I will try not to go on about too much because I know people start to get a bit glazed around the eyes when I do that.
Ah, but you're going to do it anyway, aren't you?
Probably. On the other hand, and the thing is, it's really easy to do. It's something that I don't think I've ever fallen down on that side of the rabbit hole. I probably fall down on the other side where I have something that is character driven but very plot based in how it proceeds forward, and actually I have too much plot. We know this happens because I write accidental books, and it would be impossible to do that if you didn't already have too much plot.
Yeah, I think George R. R. Martin is also quite guilty of this.
Yes.
Yeah. Having two, and I'm so guilty of this as well, where I'm like, but what about this person? And my brain's like, no, Madeleine.
No, we haven't checked in with so-and-so for a while.
Don't do it. I could tie this in. No, don't complicate it. Your readers are already confused.
And it is a really easy thing to do. I mean, in the sense of nothing really happening, that's when I think what you have to look at is the fact that, okay, you're in love with your characters. You must be, otherwise you wouldn't want to write about them. Even if they're despicable, you must be a little bit in love with them. And the whole idea is if you're into the backstory more than you're into the actual plot that you're trying to write, and more stuff is happening in the backstory than is happening in the plot, maybe you should be writing a novel about the backstory.
Yeah. It's interesting. When you told me about this episode, I suddenly thought of a quote from Steven Spielberg, which I actually think is quite relevant. And he said, "People have forgotten how to tell a story. Stories don't have a middle or an end anymore. They usually have a beginning that never stops beginning."
I think that's a fair point, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because first of all, he's really talking about film rather than books, and I think that we could discuss necessarily what he's actually talking about here. And on the one side, I think that it's a commentary on the fact that you have a lot of blockbuster kind of movies that come out where it's just explosion after explosion after explosion, but nothing actually ever really changes. There is no real development in plot, in character, or anything like that. So on the one side, it could be talking about that. But I do think that, yeah, the essential part is a lack of development, and the fact that if the whole story is actually just about establishing the background and the things that came before, then you might not actually be telling the right story. And I think it's very different from if you are telling a story which is reminiscent, where because if you're telling a story which is reminiscent, then the background is actually the plot. But we're seeing cases of, as you say, Jules, it I think we can probably just say literary fiction. It's not always literary fiction.
I'm so glad you said that before I did. I was like, I can't pick on literary fiction again. I
No,
can't do
no, we're, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I'm throwing it under the bus. Where it's like nothing's happened.
it's like
Oh my God.
I've just read 300 pages and I only feel like the story's getting going now. Yeah, and it's very irritating. It's something that's feeding into a lot of young adult fiction recently. It doesn't seem to be hitting fantasy and sci-fi in quite the same way yet. But you do see it in a lot of young adult fiction, and it's a case of I'm two-thirds of the way through the book. Why is the plot only starting now? This bit of the plot really should have started in the second chapter.
Can you give me some examples?
I would think of things like Heart of Thorns, which came out fairly recently. Which, it's one of these ones that build itself as a big feminist sort of fantasy thing. And, for the first third of the book, it really was backstory and us being told how brilliant the character was. And she's actually got one of the most mediocre intelligences I've ever seen on a character. So that didn't sell for me in any case. But there are similar books as well. I don't want to just diss that one. But I read a lot of young adult fiction as advanced reader copies, and some of it really just doesn't seem to get going until the third act, and then suddenly you're cut off and left on a cliffhanger to make you buy the next book. And I feel very strongly that this is cheating the reader. So, yeah, I won't give a dirty laundry list of books that I think this about because everyone's got a different opinion, but it is a bugbear. I've just finished a book called The Spellbook of Katrina Van Tassel, which is allegedly a feminist retelling of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And my view in the end was that it didn't really work. It didn't really work telling this story as commercial when women's fiction, and it didn't really work in it being a feminist retelling, so I didn't find it feminist at all. That's just my opinion. There are good things about it and bad things. The trouble is that the Legend of Sleepy Hollow is like about 80 pages long, and the Spellbook of Katrina Van Tassel was like 350 pages. There was not enough plot to drive the story. As in half the book happens after the end of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and it doesn't go off on its own and chart new territory. It just tries to continue the same story. And it's that cheated feeling of getting through something and thinking there isn't enough story for this amount of book. There just isn't.
What are you doing?
On the other
Look,
hand,
you.
yes, someone else would love it probably, but I do feel it's a massive cop out. And I think the thing is that the writer was probably really in love with the original story by Washington Irving, and she loved her characters and her take on it to the point where she was so close she couldn't see that actually she didn't have enough plot. It is where that's come from for me. And as someone who has too much plot and is in love with subplots and will put in seven subplots if she possibly can, and squeeze in a few more, and has every character have their own agenda. I'm not saying this is a good thing. This is something I need to pare back on, probably. So I write shorter books. As somebody who does that, I do find a lack of plot really frustrating.
Am I going to do it? Am I going to do it? I'm going to do it. So, okay. I think it's something important to do is to make a distinction between books which do this, which are the start, and books which then start to do it later on. And I think that if you're kind of in a series of books and you get one of them which is more heavily backstory, people are going to be pissed off. But I think we're willing to forgive it a little bit more, because if you are investing in a larger universe, that becomes part of a larger plot.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, and I think we'll also excuse it a little bit because at this point, if it's backstory about characters that we know and we like, you know, it's a little bit of fodder for us. It's something that, you know, especially if it's a character that you enjoy, getting a little bit of extra from them. Because the important thing is that, yeah, plot is like a skeleton, all right? But in order to make an attractive human being, you do need more than a skeleton. The skeleton is incredibly important, and without it, it's boneless. Sorry.
Not your best effort.
It's not even a good one, but, you know, had to do it. But, you know, having a little bit of muscle, a little bit of, you know, skin, these kinds of things, they're good. And so if you have a book which is a bit fatter, so it's got a skeleton, but actually, you know, we're looking at some of the other things, then fine. That's absolutely fine. But there are some people who won't accept that. And I think a very good example of a book where nothing happens is one that Jules feels particularly strongly about.
Oh, are you sure you want to open that can of worms?
I'm opening it.
Worms all over the table.
It's all over. They're wiggling around. Is A Court of Frost and Starlight.
That's not a book.
It's a novella. It's a novella. And even novellas should have some bones. And Jules, I feel that you would argue it doesn't. Now, on the subject of making shit happen, how does that correspond with your impression of A Court of Frost and Starlight?
You are such a wind-up merchant.
I am, but you know what? Our listeners love it, so...
Okay, okay, I'm going to really try and look at this with a cold, dark, adapted eye here. A Court of Frost and Starlight, aka A Court of Sex and Shopping, is more a collection of disparate, unconnected scenes. It doesn't have an overall arc. There's no character development. There's no room for character development. But, you know, even in a novella, you should be able to have character development. It should still be a story. Depending on the size of a novella, you have room for at least one subplot. And it really isn't. It's kind of like the outtakes, but written at the end. And honestly, I genuinely understand the urge to, when you finish basically the main thrust of a plot, to write scenes to tell you that your characters are happy, that you know you're not torturing them for a change. I've done that. I have scenes from Unveiled that nobody will ever see because they are literally just bollocks kind of characters getting a cup of coffee together type scenes.
You know, I want to see them, right?
I couldn't sell them, I think, is what I'm getting at. I would feel that I was cheating people by saying I want you to pay money to read this shit where nothing happens, where I'm just not torturing them, and it's just a case of to get a glimpse of people that you love doing ordinary stuff. And that is what that novella is to me. The only thing that really seems to happen in there is you get some conflict between Feyre and Nestor, and that is such a travesty that I wasn't really counting that as plot. It felt so forced.
I could argue, however, that it does have plot in the sense that it begins the movement for the next story. It is this transitional piece.
I think we could have had the next story without it.
I think you might be right. I think you might be right. But there are a lot of people who still enjoyed A Court of Frost and Starlight. So why is that when traditionally, and I'm agreeing with you, Jules. I think that traditionally we do need to make shit happen. But I also think we need to understand why actually sometimes we are tempted not to make shit happen, and why even some readers will enjoy it if shit doesn't happen.
Yeah, I completely agree. Alan has no patience for the first Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows film because he feels that not enough happens in that film. He feels that it was a money spinner. I can see his point. He's probably right. On the other hand, I really, really loved that book, and I was happy. If they'd wanted to make another three films of just Hermione and Harry wandering around Dartmoor, I'd have been like, yeah, fine, I'll sit and watch that. And I realise that that is not a rational or even a particularly critical viewpoint of that material. That's me saying, I'm happy to watch coffee shop scenes of this. And I suppose it's kind of like you saying, yeah, I'd really like to read those unveiled scenes that you won't show anyone.
Coffee shop, AU. Sorry.
I completely get. I mean, if you wanted to send me scenes of, Zachary goes to the market to buy a new shirt, I'd kind of like, I'd be all over that, like fly on shit. So I get it, but there is a difference between duty to your readers, I think, and fan service. And fan service is a wonderful thing, but I don't think you can expect your readers, who may not be like die-hard super fans, to just pay 7 or 8 quid for a book that is essentially the outtake scenes that you wrote to comfort yourself after, torturing your characters for an entire series, which essentially is what mine are.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay, so let's talk about making shit happen then.
Yeah, before we do that, let's just a mention on backstory. This is obviously a writing focused episode, so with backstory, a couple of do's and don'ts. Obviously, do have a great backstory and know it yourself. Once you've got your backstory, forget about it. Sum it up for your readers. Don't info dump, and absolutely don't write a prologue that gives the entire backstory. No one wants to read a 70-page prologue that tells you the backstory of everything that happens in that world. Drip feed it in over time. That's like one of my major bugbears is a prologue that is literally just backstory.
Yeah, I think that context giving prologues shut me down straight away. I don't have a lot of time for them.
No, and 9 times out of 10, I will just close the book if that's the case. Because quite often they don't really relate to the story that's being told, and if you can't tell the story that's being told, that's probably not the story you should be telling. So it's a case of, what does your reader really need to know? On the subject of making shit happen, there are three questions you need to ask yourself. So, I'm going to put Madeline on the spot here.
No.
She'll be fine. She knows exactly what she's doing. She makes shit happen in her books.
Do
If you haven't read her books, go and read her books and you'll see what I mean. Shit does happen. It's
Shit
not
happens a
good.
lot.
Bad stuff happens. Bad shit happens a lot in Madeline's books. But I'm gonna ask her the questions, and she's just off the cuff going to answer so that you get an example.
Oh, Christ, okay.
I haven't told her that I was gonna do this to her, so be kind. So, okay, let's take and pick one of your books that you're working on at the moment. If you want to pick Kestrel, I'm fine with that.
All right, Kestrel.
Okay, so first of all, what sort of novel is it?
Urban fantasy, new adult.
Yep, great. Who is your reader? You know.
Reader, mostly towards young women between the ages of 18 and 30, to be honest.
And me, obviously. I'm an outlier.
I mean, I'm not saying you can't read it. I'm just saying who the target audience is.
Okay. What experience do you want your reader to have reading your book?
I want them to enjoy it primarily. I want them to find humor in it, but also, I think one of the things about the book is examining some of the darker parts of life that we go through in a realistic way, whilst putting it in a very unrealistic setting.
Yeah, okay, great. So once you've got those three things down, if you can't answer those three questions, you kind of need to go back to the start and really think about them till you've got them. But obviously, Madeline knows what she's doing. So if I then said to Madeline, who is your protagonist?
Kestrel.
Kestrel. Yeah, but who is Kestrel?
Okay, she is an acerbic ex-wizard who just kind of wants to be left alone because the world has kind of shit on her and she's really sort of had enough. And the call for adventure comes for her and she tries desperately to ignore it, but in the end, she can't, and she ends up going for it, and she kind of goes through life complaining but also secretly loving it.
Okay, so then you look at things like what is this character's problem? And I don't mean that in a kind of God, what's your problem, man? I mean sort of like there's two distinct routes here. There's the internal or emotional problem and the external plot-based problem for each book. So
So the external problem for Kestrel is in the first book is that she has wound up in the middle of something that she doesn't actually have the power to deal with. She's trying to go for a normal life because after an accident she had a few years ago, she's lost all of her magic. And she says, "That's fine, I just want a normal life now. So I don't really have time for any of this Knight of the Round Table bullshit." And being attacked by trolls and other things like that. The internal problem, of course, is that actually she does want to be part of the magical world and she's gutted that she lost her magic. And when it comes back, that's not really too much of a spoiler, but when she gets pulled back into this whole magical world, she suddenly has to figure out what she wants and whether it's worth the price.
so people listening, particularly writers, you can see there that the internal problem and the external problem are already directly at odds with each other. So stuff is already happening. You know, shit is going to go down from that because you have those two things that are basically plot threads, the internal and the external, reflecting each other backwards. So they're already in conflict. So the thing is, you can have a plot-centric book whereby the character doesn't really grow and change, for example, like Sherlock Holmes. You can have character centric, which mine do tend to be. And you can have a book where it's kind of plot and character, where you know it's plot driven, but the character does change for something like, say, for example, say Die Hard, which I know is a random example. But you know, the character really does have to change, and yet the plot is the thing moving everything forward. So, next question, does your character grow and change?
She does. Yeah, she does grow and change. Not always for the better. But it would be very unrealistic not to be affected by the circumstances that she has to go through and the decisions that she has to make, and specifically the entire premise is that she does need to grow and change because she was living in status before and now she has to make a decision. So the only way she can make that decision is to change.
Yeah. So, you know, already you can see that Madeline's got a very clear idea of where she's going with the book, what's happening, that stuff is going down, there's going to be action. And not necessarily action, when we say an action scene, we don't necessarily mean, oh yeah, everyone breaks out their kung fu. What we mean is something is actually happening. And this is another another side thing is it's really worth looking at your scenes of, so with your book, make a list of the scenes where something is happening that is changing your character and making the arc move forward. And then of those scenes, go through and put an asterisk by all the ones that are action based rather than conversation based. Now, the thing is, conversation and dialogue is really important in fiction, but if you have scenes where it's literally just conversation, it's weak. There's not enough happening. And you have too many of those scenes and people are going to lose interest. So, I'm going to use myself as an example because it's not fair to always pick on Madeline.
Thanks.
For example, in I Rule the Night, Em's internal conflict is the fact that she's not really sure whether she should be pursuing a romantic relationship with Kieran or not because of things that happened in the past. It's no spoiler to say that. And they do try and get over this. They do talk quite a lot in that book, I think. Yeah. They probably talk, whether they communicate well is another thing, but they talk a lot trying to get things right, trying to sort things out. And every time I have them talk, I have them going on quite a long walk. So they are literally making a character journey as they're talking and changing. And when things are particularly difficult and they're talking about relationship stuff or trying to get over things, I've got them literally walking uphill. And yeah, possibly that's a heavy-handed metaphor, but the whole sort of going for a walk, it becomes basically a metaphor for the fact that they're taking steps forward on their journey to try and connect as a pair.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a minor plot thread, really, for the entire book. But there's always something happening there in that respect.
I think a really important thing to consider on whether you feel like it might very well be that you feel as a writer that you've written a scene where nothing is really happening, but actually maybe something is happening and maybe you just need to extenuate that. That's not the right word. Exaggerate that.
Yes.
And a good way of looking at it is take your character, your main character, and ask yourself, if at the end of this scene, is it possible for them to be doing exactly the same thing and thinking exactly the same thing they were at the beginning? Now, on a logical basis, we do that all the time. Think about someone interrupting you while you're in the middle of work. You have a chat with them. You go back to the task at hand. Okay. Now, the way our brains work mean that every time we have an interaction with someone, it's going to change something just a little bit within us. It might be a new ideas pop into your head. But remember, when we're talking about literature and when we're talking about books, everything's just a little bit exaggerated. So use that as a test to say, has something changed? Okay. And then look at that change within your character. Is that just a superficial change? And even if it is a superficial change, could that superficial change then lead on to a significant change? And that's the way that you can track your plot and make sure that you are not just relying too much on stuffing. Okay, you've not, your whole meal isn't just cabbage. Having cabbage in a meal is good, you know. Adding more, you know, the volume, that is good. We're not saying don't do that. But you've got to make sure that you've got that structure. And a good way of doing that is, as Jill said, marking when these events occur and always saying to yourself, at the end of every chapter, I like to say, my character, they're obviously the same person, but they are a little bit different at the end of the chapter than they were at the beginning. And it might just be something as small as they might be a little bit angrier. Okay, or maybe they might be a little bit more hopeful, or maybe there is an ultimate change. They've made a decision, things like that. At the end of every chapter, there should be a change, and it should be leading on to the next step, like a flight of stairs.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, when you're looking at your overall plot, I'm not necessarily going to ask you to for spoilers here, but if you want
Are
to
you
volunteer,
sure?
if you want
like,
to, I'm
speaking of book two, tell me about the.
Okay, personally, I would totally be doing that, but I'm not gonna. I'm not quite that selfish to do that with you. I'm just going to keep nagging you until you present to me with it, you know, so I can read it. So expect that. Yeah, you have to think. In terms of your character conflict and mm-hmm. look at, as Madeline was saying about, you know, exaggerating it and making it stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Think, can I put them through something more? So ask yourself, literally ask yourself, what is the worst thing in the world that can happen to this person, to this character? And then decide when it's going to happen. I mean,
yes.
I mean, basically, this is a case of, okay, again, I'll take I Rule the Night. And the absolute worst thing that could have happened to M in that book wasn't actually dying. It was losing herself and finding that that perhaps she'd been right with her doubts, that she was too dangerous to be with, too dangerous to be loved. So that was actually the worst thing that could happen to her. So obviously, at some point in I Rule the Night, I have that happen.
Yeah. That does happen to Kestrel on two folds. It happens on a physical sense, and it also happens on an emotional one as well. I've mentioned before, right at the beginning, Kestrel has lost her powers, and even though this is straight off the bat, you can get this from the first few pages, even though she's insisting that everything is fine, you see the way that she's living. She's very clearly depressed. She's very clearly in denial, and she's really struggling with what's happened to her. And because she had this accident, and it has had a profound effect on her, and we get more of that as the series goes on. And what she wants really desperately, deep in her heart of hearts, is to go back to the way that she was, to have her magic back, to feel like she did. And what inevitably actually happens is that she does get her magic back, but it does come with this price tag. And without giving too much away, she has to sacrifice something in that she gets her power, her magic back, but she loses a sense of power that she has because there's a promise that comes with it and there's a job description that comes with it. And she's put in the situation where she's given a choice. And I'll come back to that in a second. But on the physical side of things, the worst thing that is possible happens at her, which is that she has been keeping her family separate from this. And of course, they end up getting involved and they end up getting hurt. And so on a physical sense, that's the worst possible thing that could happen to her. And on the emotional sense, the worst possible thing is that she gets her wish and suddenly has to realize the consequences of that wish. Because there is literally a scene, and I can't remember whether I keep the lines or not, where, you know, she mentions that a week ago she would have grabbed this opportunity, you know, without a second doubt. A few years ago, she would have grabbed this opportunity. Right at the beginning, Galahad shows up. He really does show up right at the beginning, and she says, look, hey, if you'd been here a few years ago, this would have been awesome, but I can't do this now. And that is this general premise of I can't do this now, because there is too much to lose. And in the end, despite gaining everything, despite getting her powers back, despite getting her family back, she has ultimately lost. And the book tries to end on a hopeful twist of, well, not everything is lost. I still have time to, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Sort this out. But I think that is a big part of it is actually sort of the reality of wishes, the reality of responsibility and power.
And that's the thing, you have to know your character well enough to know what the worst thing would be, and then you have to not pull your punches if you want the book to have any sort of impact.
And... oh yeah, hurt them, man, hurt them. Your favourite Put them through hell. Look at what I did to Rufus. I mean, look what you did to Emmeline. Jeez.
Yeah, this is why I have those scenes where everything's normal, everything's fine, that no one will read. Yeah, and you know, it's understandable. You want to like go for the hurt instead of the kill, and you just can't do that all the time. You can't do that really at all. But it's worth bearing in mind that if you say to someone, "What's the worst thing that can happen?" and they'll say, "Well, you know, we die," and it's like, actually, that's not the worst thing that can happen to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Sometimes the worst thing that can happen is that you're left alive, but.
It's interesting enough because we talk about, you know, sort of going in for the kill. And let's drag George R. R. Martin onto the podium here. Hey, George. So you killed Ned Stark. Sorry, not sorry. That's hardly a spoiler anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, for God's sake, they cast Sean Bean. Everyone should have known. He killed Ned Stark. That is literally a case of someone going for the kill. But actually, Ned Stark's death wasn't the worst thing that could happen to him. It was actually the worst thing that could happen to a lot of other people,
yeah.
But it wasn't the worst thing that could happen to him. And that's really interesting, because the worst thing that could have happened to Ned is his daughter, is his family being made unsafe. And actually, right before he's executed, he sees that Arya, at least he believes, is safe.
Yeah.
And he knows that his family's safe. And, you know, even though he was told he was going to get away, I think he kind of already knew that he was going to get executed. I don't think it came as a big surprise. I don't think he was shocked by Joffrey's decision, to be honest. He took it very, very calmly. It wasn't the worst thing that could happen to him. And that was a case of, yeah, a main character who really, yeah, who became the worst thing that could happen for everybody else, because it really triggers a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, moving on very slightly, I'm going to put Madeline on the spot again.
Yay!
So, another good way to help drive the plot is have your secondary or tertiary characters reflect the MC's conflict in a positive or negative way. So, I'm going to ask Madeline for a secondary character and then ask what that character wants and how that reflects.
I could go with Galahad, but I think I'm actually going to go with Peter here.
Okay.
Now, Peter is Kestrel's best friend from childhood. They're like siblings. He's a non-powered individual, but he's in on the secret. And in a very kind of typical wow sort of way, he is excited by magic. He's excited by the world that Kestrel lives in. And when she loses her power, after she's gone into a state of I don't care anymore, he still does care. And on the one side, that's a very that's very much because he's looking at Kestrel and he's seeing that she's not doing well at all. But on the other side, it's a very personal thing for him because he wants in on that world again, and she is the doorway in on that world.
Yeah. So again, you can see that he sort of straddles the line, doesn't he, between having a normal life and being relatively safe and
mm-hmm.
having what her heart's desire ultimately, even
yeah.
though she won't admit it to herself. So again, you've got him reflecting it in a fairly positive way, but there are definitely drawbacks as well.
Yeah, definitely. And also because he becomes a symbol of the sacrifice that she has to make, because he's one of the people who ends up getting hurt.
Yeah.
Ultimately. And he then, I mean, I don't mind saying this, rather than go down the traditional, right, I don't want you any part of this anymore, I've got to abandon my friends and family, Kestrel realizes that he's not going anywhere and that he is a part of this now, and she can't stop him being a part of it. So she kind of pulls him into the fold a little bit more and just says, right, you have to be he wants it, and she says, right, we're going to train you to be extraordinary. I'm going to train you on how to deal with these situations. You're going to learn to fight, things like that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because they're kind of meeting in the middle, where she's striving to maintain a level of normalcy, and he's obviously striving to gain the incredible. And rather than that being a conflict between them, because it was a little bit at the beginning, because he's pushing her, because we see it as a conflict all the time. I just watched season two of Jessica Jones, for instance, and the whole kind of thing with Trish being envious of Jessica, and Jessica
Yeah.
saying, oh my God, don't you realize what you've got? And that was used as a conflict. And rather than do a conflict, I wanted to flip that and say, actually, it's part of a balance in that they actually help each other out, and they help each other stay stable and create a new level of normal, which is this in-between state, because they represent each side, and both are valid.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, while having your secondary and tertiary characters reflect the main conflict, that doesn't mean they can't have agency and desires and agendas of their own. For example, in, let's say, I Rule the Night, Kieran's main agenda there is just to go off to university and have a fairly normal life with his girlfriend. And you know, lots of stuff gets in the way of that. I mean, part of the thing is he's an adventurous person, and he finds an adventure as well. I mean, he obviously loves her anyway, but you know, that's kind of sometimes he's reflecting her conflict in a really negative way because
Yeah.
he's trying to deal with stuff that he's trying to deal with feelings that he's never had to process before. And sometimes it's reflected in a really positive way, and it flips back and forth. But his agenda always stays the same. He's always reaching for the same thing,
Yeah.
and it's not diverted. He's not just an appendage to her story.
Now, I think that's also really important, and I must have said it before, but remember that every character is the hero of their own story. And it
Yeah.
might be that their story's maybe a little bit less interesting, which hopefully should be the case. I think we've had examples where, side characters are more interesting than the main
You're
characters,
kind of
and
like,
you're
why are
like,
you not writing this
why
guy's novel?
yeah, why am I seeing it from this person's point of view? Really, they have nothing to say, and I don't care. like, what was it? Someone pointed out that's really the case in Twilight. Like, screw Bella and Edward. I want to talk about vampires in the Civil War and being
Yeah, I mean.
psychic in a psychic vampire in an insane asylum, and things like that. There were some
Humbled.
pretty interesting side characters in Twilight. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
But yeah, the side characters are always have to have their own agency. They always have to have their own story, and they have to have their own development. Now, their development does not need to be directly tied with your main character. And if you're writing a series, you may very well see your side characters develop quicker or slower. It might be that the side characters take longer, and you do actually get that a lot, especially in stories where the side characters become more prominent as time goes on, because they need longer to develop, and because different circumstances are going to help them develop. But the important thing to remember is that you should always be moving toward that, and that in order to make a side character, and I think it's important to make a distinction here between side characters and background characters. A side character is someone who is intrinsic to the plot, or is intrinsic. Their relationship is important to the main character. It's all tied in.
Yeah.
And so that side character does need to be involved in the plot. And they do need to develop. And that means that they also at some point are going to have to face their greatest fear,
Yeah.
in some form or another. And actually, let's pick on. I'm gonna do this to you now, Jules. If we put Kieran and Emmeline to the side and look at I Rule the Night, you have Emmeline living with these other students who didn't ask for this
Poor
crap.
unsuspecting innocents.
And actually, each of them, despite not getting that much, page time, each of them actually have to face their own thing. And I'm going to pick on Craig and Kelsey here,
Yeah.
in that Craig has to face the supernatural,
Which
despite the
abs
fact he really doesn't want to face the supernatural.
No, it terrifies him. He's had a past experience that he isn't even sure that he remembers correctly.
And then not
And
only does he have to face the possibility of the supernatural, he then literally has to face the thing which caused him massive trauma right
yes.
at the end. So thanks for that, Jules. And then you get Kelsey, and you have Kelsey facing her fears as well. And the nice thing about Kelsey is, I mean, you're even writing her story now, is that you get this definite sense of the beginning. There's something already going on there, and that there's something is brewing, and it's all related nicely, and it's all tied nicely in. But this is a character that you can instantly see. She goes through her first stage of development through Emmeline, but it's not finished yet, and
No,
that's really
definitely not.
interesting. So this is a great example of the development of characters, and despite the fact that I know you hate A Court of Frost and Starlight, or A Court of Sex and Shopping, we do start to see the beginnings of that. And yeah, you could argue that we didn't really need to see it there. It could have all been encapsulated into a book, which got into the plot quicker. You could argue with that that's the case. But we do start to see that happening. That rumination of development or develop that is required in characters like Nesta, and in characters like Elaine, and Cassian, and this idea of something bad is brewing, and that's going to be the plot of the next book. And as you say, we could have probably just gone straight into the next book and just then had it be the plot. We didn't really need the bridge. But I think the whole point of that book was, without actually any plots happening, it was putting to bed some characters and saying, right, and that's them put to the side, and now the side characters are coming forward to be the main characters.
Yeah. And if that book had focused more on those side characters, I would have probably liked it a lot more because there's more there, you know, there is more to do there ultimately. There's more shit happening.
Yeah, well, you know my feelings. There was one side character I wanted and I didn't get him. So, apart from in like one flimsy scene where he's interrupted and abused, so that's my feeling on the matter. But even in that case, we get the sense of development. It's not like everything's the same. We get this kind of this sense of oh, Lucian's now joined up with a bunch of other people. They've got a band name and
Yeah, that's true. Okay, last sort of 10, 15 minutes, just going to whiz through the last bit and look at endings, but there's specific parts of the ending I want to look at.
Yeah.
And okay, yes, I am delving more into structure here. If you haven't noticed me doing that for the rest of the podcast, brilliant. I've got to ask you. And hopefully I'm
I see
giving you
what you're doing.
subliminal messages by saying, ask yourself this question. Yeah. Ultimately, before you get to the this I mean, the thing is, ask yourself if you know the ending for a start. You might not. You might completely surprise yourself with the ending when you finally write it, and that's fine too. But if you do know the ending, you kind of need to know how you're going to get there. Now, there should be a point after your midpoint reversal when there's a massive shift in your character. There should be a point sort of about three quarters of the way the book, perhaps a little bit more, called the point of greatest despair. And that's the point where it looks like everything has gone to shit. You know, everything's gone wrong. The character cannot possibly win against these odds. And that doesn't necessarily need to mean that bigger monsters have come in. It just means that something has gone really, really badly wrong. And basically, this is the point where you are asking yourself, what absolutely huge thing is happening now that will keep your readers on the edge of their seat? So very much like the what's the worst thing that can possibly happen to this person, but in this scenario with these pressures on them. So over to Madeline. The point of greatest despair.
Point of greatest despair for Kestrel is she's made it to, she's been given a task and she's made it right up to the end of the task itself, and then she finds that she can't complete it. And as punishment for not completing it, her last, the last person she can rely on is taken from her.
Yeah.
And she's left in this state of already knowing that she couldn't do it alone, and now she truly is alone. And that it's the moment of greatest despair. She's lost everything. She really has lost everything. That she's to the point that she thought she'd lost everything, and then she lost that little bit more that she didn't even realise she had, and now it's gone too.
You are hashtag evil author.
I am. But you know, you think book one is bad. It's so tame compared to what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I can hardly wait.
So tame.
Yeah, so okay, once you've got past the point of greatest despair, things need to start picking up again. And this is the point that I would call storm the castle. So, that again, this doesn't mean that you bring in lots of Michael Bay type special effects or whatever, unless it does, unless that's kind of what you've got envisaged anyway. But it should, so many writers don't land the ending, including Stephen King, actually. Sometimes he really just doesn't land the ending, and you feel that everything's fallen a bit flat. And ideally an ending, whether it's going to be bitter, sweet, or somewhere in between the two, whether it's going to be a happy ending or a cautionary ending, it should be satisfying. So you should feel that, yes, they've gone through hell, and maybe they've failed and it was a glorious failure, or maybe they haven't failed or whatever, but it should fit.
Yeah. So I think the important thing to remember is, and I've mentioned this again on a previous episodes when I talked about motivations and character motivations, and ultimately what we tend to like and what we tend to have is that throughout the book there will have been a single motivation which has carried your character. I call it the selfish motivation. It's usually, you know, a self-involved of get do this so I can go home, or get revenge, or something like that. It's not necessarily a bad motivation, but it's the selfish motivation, is in that it's very, you know, it's a small motivation, and ultimately that small motivation is what causes the failure right at the moment of greatest despair. So in the case of Kestrel, her motivation up until this point has just been get my family back, get home. And she fails literally on that motivation, because she suddenly is put in a situation where she's made to look at the cost of what would happen, of the effects of her actions. And she's suddenly made to feel like, My motivations don't justify what I'm doing. I can't justify my reasons for doing this. And ultimately that's what stops her. In a physical sense, it's not just that she goes, oh well, and, you know, throws it to the side. There is a literal physical barrier which is brought on by her self-doubt. And so this causes the moment of greatest despair. And you have got to remember as an author that in order then for them to get past the moment of greatest despair and for victory, there needs to be a change. Your character needs to have a profound enough experience that they then, their motivation shifts. And I don't necessarily mean that it changes completely. Their goal might still be the same thing, but the motivation shifts. And it's no longer just about getting revenge. It's about getting justice. Even if that means that you never get a normal life, even if that means, you know, it becomes bigger than you. And that change, that shift is ultimately what carries them into victory. And the whole kind of idea is therefore that the reason that they can go into victory is because they can change, whereas the villain is always going to be stuck on their one way of thinking, and they're stuck on that path and they can't deviate, whereas your main character, they can. But
yeah.
Again, to have that change, something profoundly large needs to have happened to them. Okay, something needs to have affected them in such a way that they can shift from a motivation which has carried them throughout the rest of the entire plot. And I think that actually that's probably where we get a lot of the downfall of the end, is that you actually haven't, they haven't changed enough. You get cases where the character just hasn't changed enough, where something big hasn't happened. They haven't been challenged enough. They haven't been put through enough of a trial. And so the product that comes out isn't ready, isn't inspiring. And you get this ending which feels a little bit lackluster because it's not exciting. You don't feel any real sense of accomplishment, I
yeah.
think. And
yeah.
that is ultimately what you're trying to create, a sense of, even if it's not a happy sense, but a sense of accomplishment that something has been finished.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, which brings me on to the final question with regard to ending, and I'm going to throw it at Madeline, and then I mm-hmm. might answer it myself. But how do you want your readers to feel at the end of the book? This is an important one. You should almost ask yourself that before you start writing the book. So, Madeline.
How do I want people to feel at the end? Like they want to get the second book.
Yeah, okay.
I want them to feel I want them to feel excited.
Yeah.
Actually. That is actually literally the idea that I want them to feel like there's another adventure coming, that all the possibilities are there, and once again, all the odds are stacked against these characters, but they've kind of got their, you know, the ace up their sleeve. We just don't know what the ace is yet. And maybe the ace is just their plucky behaviour and a lot of sarcasm. We don't know. But yeah, ultimately, that is the ending that I want. The sense of, okay, we've got through that first chapter, but it literally was just the first step. And actually, the rest of the staircase doesn't feel tiring. It's exciting. So that's what I was going for.
Yeah. Great. And
have I achieved that, Jules?
I think so, yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't keep nagging you about the second book for a start. Yeah, okay. In my case, I've been using I Rule the Night, so I'll carry on with that. But I think that's one book where I did absolutely nail the ending. Not to blow my own trumpet, but generally feedback has been, okay, I feel like that was the ending that most series should absolutely get. And it brought the character arc to the close, and I was laughing and crying at the same time, kind of thing, which is totally what I was going for. So yeah, and yet at the same time, people were also saying, yeah, but I could read a bit more, which was just as well, because then that accidental novel Betwixt and Between happened, and people have generally sort of said after that,
mm-hmm.
yeah, that's great. That is kind of like, that was a great addendum to the thing. I didn't need to read it, but I wanted to because of the ending of the fourth book. So yeah, but generally speaking, if I'm ending a book, I kind of want you to be crying your fucking eyes out. That's how I feel about it. But I also want you to feel like there's some hope there, and that you've had a good laugh along the way as well. And you know, the proportions of those three things will vary depending on what I'm writing. With Melanie Beckett, I think you're going to be laughing more than crying most of it. I say at the moment.
Oh no, I know you. See, the problem with the making the shit happen is that that does actually mean creating some form of investment.
Yeah, that's fair. There is emotional investment. And, you know, people should ideally feel attached to your characters and suffer with them when they suffer.
Yep. Because otherwise, why should we care about what happens to them? So yeah, that's another reason to make shit happen. Make literal shit happen, because you want them to hurt. My God, you want them to hurt.
So that's basically it. That is a very brief whistle stop tour through making shit happen in a book. Ask yourselves the questions we have been asking all the way through this podcast, and then you'll have structured your novel without realizing that you've even structured it. For those who don't like structure and just want to fly by the seat of their pants, actually, if you can answer these questions, you don't need to do an outline if you don't want to.
Jules, was this an episode about structure?
It's a fair cop, Governor.
Damn it.
But yeah, a lot of this stuff, when I first really got it pinned down like this, through, as I said, listening to Julie Cohen in her workshop, and then going and trying to apply it to myself and adapting it for my own usage, it was a real eye-opener. And I think if I'd have been able to do this when I was writing I Am the Silence, I wouldn't have got stuck on it for about a year and a half. Even without an outline, I think I would have been able to sort of pants my way through it, because I would have had answers to the essential questions. So that's my advice.
Okay.
That brings us to the end of my sneaky podcast on structure, where I've made Madeline complicit whether she wanted to be or not.
And on that note, guys. Oh no, wait, no, wait, before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week.
Yes.
Jules, I believe you've got one for us, but I'm not sure I agree with
Right.
it.
Let
Sorry.
me just think about this. Yeah, no, I went and saw Bohemian Rhapsody at the cinema on Friday, and it was extremely good. I know it's been slammed by critics, and some critics anyway, and a lot of it's been slammed for a negative portrayal of the queer lifestyle during the 80s. The trouble is, I lived through the 80s, and that was point for point accurate as to how people were treated and portrayed during the 80s. So I can understand why people didn't like that aspect of it. But on the other hand, historically, that was completely and utterly accurate. On the whole, though, it's a really uplifting film about someone who was quite remarkable, but, you know, absolutely definitely not a god, even if he was a musical genius. So I will say, for my part, though, that there was a lot of nostalgia, because my dad was a huge Queen fan, so I had a lot of that growing up. I did not realise that Queen had provided the soundtrack to my childhood, and that's kind of how it felt.
Okay. Well, check that out, guys. And until next week, bye bye.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.